Welcome. Yes, here we are. It is yet another Monday. We are into November, November 8th, 2021. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop Live. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. At Out to Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts, right from our own backyards and from across the country. On Friday, Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. You got to check out our The Wednesday Show with Cyril Michalako. Cyril, of course, is a progressive columnist from the Bucks County Courier-Times and the Intelligencer, and he joins me to drill down into Bucks County, Pennsylvania, international politics, whatever we feel like talking about. That show usually comes in about every other week after his column drops. You can get all our shows by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And you can help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month. Head on over to patreon.com/rcpress where you can super help us. Come on. And thank you. All the folks have been joining, man. I'll tell you, September, October, November has been phenomenal. You can also help out this show by heading over to our YouTube channel, if you're not there already, and make sure you smash that subscribe button, like the stream for this show, and hit that notification bell so you know every time we go live. We are at about 175 followers at this point. My goal, I would love to hit 200 by the end of the month. So share it out there. Make sure you subscribe to our show. Even if you're not on YouTube all the time, you hit that subscribe button, you walk away. I'm good with that. That's fine. I'll take it. You can also join our Discord. Information on that is right there in today's show notes. We'll be kind of monitoring Discord through the live chat channel and throughout the show. But attention all. Oh, you got to also, God, how could I forget, right? You got to check out a couple other PA progressive talk shows. You got to go head on over to the Rick Smith Show's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern tonight. You know, better yet, just go to ricksmithshow.com for the latest across all his platforms. Because, you know, I can't keep track of them all at this time. He's got, you know, his nightly broadcast. He's got his weekly show on Free Speech TV, broadcasting WBAI and KPFK in Los Angeles. Phenomenal. And you got to check out, of course, the Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast, the amazing PA women stirring the political cauldron behind this podcast, Rock the House. And they know where the bodies are buried. Make sure to follow them at the Night Caucus on Twitter and subscribe to their podcast on Anchor, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. Absolutely fantastic folks over there. All you gamers out there, check out the Game Inn. That's in Quakertown. The Game Inn with two N's, the Quakertown-based black family-owned gaming store. They're friends of the show, and they've got everything for retro N64s, the latest consoles, video games for all platforms, collectibles, action figures, Funko Pops, you got it. Look, and we're running back to school time right now, so if your kid's a gamer, right, they get an A on the report card, send them over to the Game Inn, and they'll get a discount. You got to follow the Game Inn on Twitter at the Game Inn. Check out their Facebook page. And if you've got a question about something that's hard to find, see if they got something in stock, shoot them an email at thegameinpa@gmail.com. Special shout out, of course, goes to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at songadayman. That's with two N's. That's at songadayman on Twitter. I just want to get some programming notes. We've got some awesome shows coming up in the next couple weeks. Next Monday, 7 p.m., same bat time, same bat channel. We've got Laura Putnam on the show. Laura's a professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. She'll be on the show to talk about the growing left progressive political movements in the Pittsburgh area. And we'll talk about her article, Rust Belt and Transition, what has happened in Pennsylvania's and the Rust Belt's middle suburb counties, and can it be reversed? It's a fantastic article. We're going to be doing some breakdown of the elections and looking forward to some of the results. And then on Monday, November 22nd, we're going to be changing things up a little bit here. It's going to throw a little of the folks off here, but we're going to do it anyways. I'll be welcoming Gwen Marshall, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Florida Atlantic International University, to the show. We're going to be talking about her book, Ancestry and Culture, An Alternative to Race in 5E. What is 5e, you ask? Well, that's the fifth edition of Dungeons & Dragons, of course. Yes, indeed. This book looks to bring to the world of tabletop role-playing games a more critical and dynamic understanding of race and culture. It's really fascinating, and with the explosion of D&D throughout the pandemic, to see that folks are actually kind of like engaged with the topic of race on this game is really fascinating. So we're going to have her on the show on November 22nd. But that's not why you're here now, because on tonight's show, I'm welcoming Kirsten Zolfel of Bucks County Indivisible back to the show. We'll be checking the receipts on Republican Representative Brian Fitzpatrick, yes, here in the PA1. As we shift our attention to the 2020 midterm elections, we'll take a look at the votes that Fitzpatrick doesn't want to campaign on. Yes, Fitzpatrick's moderate credentials are a bit sus when you cut through the press releases and look at his actual voting record. I mean, what's it take to get a moderate moniker these days? I mean, some fancy footwork, perhaps? Or maybe it's just some deep pockets filled with the spoils from some dark money. We'll check it out. Zolfel will help us dig into his record in one of the most highly watched congressional districts in the country. Zolfel is a resident of Bucks County and volunteer organizer with Indivisible Bucks County. She's also in the steering committee of Pennsylvania Indivisible and as a legislative chair. And in that position, she edits and contributes to the Pennsylvania Member of Congress Tracking Report, which is an absolutely phenomenal resource. It's an effort to keep an eye on the votes and quotes from the Commonwealth's 20 members of Congress. Kirsten is originally from New Jersey, but moved to PA when she was an undergrad at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster. And she's stuck around in the area ever since. Now, you'll be able to work the second part of the show today. I want to remind you that you'll be able to call in or kind of give your comments. We'll be tracking comments all throughout the show, but we'll take a break right about quarter to eight or so, and we'll take a quick break. And then if you want to call into the show, you got questions, you want to give updates about where you're at, what happened for you this past week, you can check in at the later part of the show. That's on riverside.fm. Info's in today's show notes. So Kirsten, welcome back to the show. I'm so psyched to have you here tonight.
Hi, Gavin. I am so happy to be here. It's 2022. We are in the race now.
Yeah, I tell you, it's like it seems like it's already knocking on the door. I mean, 2021 elections are just, you know, it seems like they're not even cold, and already the election for 2022 is heating up. But listen, before we get to 2022, I'm just, you know, we've had about almost a week now since last week's elections. And I'm just really curious about your take and kind of what your thoughts are about kind of where things ended up, how the races went, and kind of what are your feelings about, if anything, what this means about going forward.
So, I mean, I'm disappointed for Bucks. It sounds like across the country, it wasn't quite the drubbing that we had here in the county, but obviously having lost every row office that was up, you know, it hurts. I will say the race that hurts me the most locally is my township supervisors. Thankfully, there's still a Democratic majority here in Newtown Township. It's 3-2 now. But a friend of mine, Ellen Snyder, was running, and I was helping her campaign a little bit. So she lost, I want to say it might be only in two figures worth of votes, and there was over 7,000 votes cast. So, you know, it hurts. But the thing about activism is, like, I gave myself from Tuesday through Friday to be upset about it, and then I was like, okay, we're back into it. Like, my 3 days of sitting shiva for the 2021 elections, and now we're rolling again. But there were definitely some missteps. I feel like there were definitely things that we should take away from this for the future. Social media usage is one of them. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much you are on Facebook. I am on Facebook a lot because I admin a bunch of groups. And I, as a registered independent, I get to see things sometimes that are a little bit different than, you know, what the Dem cluster gets to see. And I will tell you that every single day from July 4th through the election, I saw ads for the Republican sheriff candidate, for the Republican DA, and for my Republican Republican supervisor candidates. And I didn't see anything from Democrats.
Nothing. Yeah, it's interesting. I remember you kind of at first mentioned that to me, and I was like, hey, you know, that's a really kind of interesting take on it, especially because sometimes, Democrats, I think, had a reputation for a while of being ahead of the game on social media. And I don't think that's the case anymore. I mean, I think that's, you've got some really savvy and smart kind of social media gurus on the right, plus they're backed by a ton of money. Which, you know, those Facebook ads, you know, you're talking about, I mean, they don't come cheap. I mean, that's something that to make sure that they've got, you know, floor to ceiling coverage on the platforms and targeting them in the way that they are, it, you know, tells us a whole lot about where we need to go going forward, certainly.
Yeah. It was disappointing to me because if you think about how these municipal races go, like obviously you have your core group of people who know that they're going to turn out. And then it becomes all about convincing that whatever group of people you can get to turn out in addition to that. And sometimes name recognition is all that really matters in some of those races. Like you could conceivably get someone who turns out because they feel really passionate about the DA race or the sheriff's race. And they might just not know about the other races. And now that there's not a party line vote option, you know, we need to build name recognition for some of the candidates that are further down the ballot. So I hope that the party will take action along those lines in future elections and leverage all the wonderful activists we have who will give them free coverage on Twitter and in Facebook groups and in Facebook pages and stuff. Because,
We do need it. And I think that I'll say this is one of the things that was good about, you know, not jumping in into the Twitter fray too much after the election, kind of, and then reading around and kind of seeing what's going on. One of the things that was really clear to me is as devastating as the losses in the Penrith School District where I am were, I mean, where we've got like literally now QAnon adherence on our school board. It was already off the rails and now it's even further that way. But anyways, is that the thing that stuck out to me most, and I think it's going to be important going forward, is that the parents of community members who organized around this campaign and the candidates who actually ran, they did an outstanding job of organizing. I mean, if you want to talk about everything that you're supposed to do in terms of building power in a campaign and what you're saying, like name recognition, everything, they were knocking doors incessantly. They were using social, like Facebook groups and things like this, not to just like chime in about what they thought about stuff, but actually planning, okay, where are we meeting next? How does this happen? What do we do? Where do we miss? How do we make sure that we got coverage over here and doing that kind of door knocking and stuff. And so, and I saw the same thing in Palisades. There was the same thing was happening in Central Bucks County around the school board elections. And so there's a lot of energy there. And my biggest concern, I guess, going forward is like, you know, is like keeping people focused on the organizing in their communities as opposed to like, okay, let's just talk about like messaging about Democrats. No, let's actually do the organizing around candidates in our community, it seems to me. But
yeah, we actually have two Indivisible events coming up later on this week.
Oh, please plug them, please. We can talk about this is good.
These are visibility events as much as anything. So I hope that if folks can't turn out for them, that they will at least amplify them in their groups. But it's along with there's a national coalition, and I'm going to kick myself because I never remember the name. It's like, you know what? I'm not going to make a mistake with the name, but it's in defense of democracy, in defense of the voting rights, and particularly to end the filibuster. So we're going to be having one event where we're getting people out with nice big lit up signs on the bridge across the Lambertville New Hope Bridge saying bust the filibuster. And then those same signs will make an appearance at the 413-332 intersection. One of them's Thursday night, the other's Friday night. So it's as much about just making sure people know that, like, we still need to kill the filibuster. Like, it still needs to go away for us to protect voting rights. And also, hopefully, to reconnect with some of those Fridays with Fitzpatrick folks who came out so often in 2017 and 2018. We're going to get them out. Same time, same place, same night, same location. So, yeah, we'll see how it goes.
No, fantastic. But I mean,
get rolling.
Yeah, well, and I think we are. I mean, I think, you know, I think that's already going that far. So, those losses in Bucks County really hurt, in the ways that you said. It seems to me a lot of these folks that were out organizing are not going away, and new people, a lot of younger people. You know, well, look, and I think that when you start messing with people's kids around things like COVID and their education, it's then it becomes personal. And then you start looking for other folks to organize. And I saw that happening. So, you know, we're going to do our best to be part of that and kind of helping foster that too as well. I certainly know that you all are going to be doing that and continue to do that, haven't gone away since you started. So, and I think it's important to, you know, to acknowledge that because, I mean, like we started this with, 2022 is literally right around the corner. And we're sitting here in the PA first, right? The PA-01. Where Brian Fitzpatrick is kind of holding on to power in one of the, you know, what is going to be one of the more expensive congressional races and is going to be one of the most closely watched one. Because it, you know, there is a good chance that the Democrats could lose the House in 2022 unless we get some serious organizing that's happening and flip some of the seats and hold on to the ones that we need to. So as you're kind of looking forward, you know, with Fitzpatrick, I mean, kind of what's your read about moving forward? And then we got to get into some of the, you know, who is this guy, Fitzpatrick, who seems to be full of goodwill?
So will you let me just put in a correction? So the name that I couldn't remember, it's the Declaration for American Democracy Coalition. That's why I can't remember the name because it's so darn long. But it's this 230 organizations from like the NAACP to Greenpeace to Indivisible. And they're the ones who are doing this week of action this week. Okay. So that aside, moving on to Fitzpatrick. I think the key here is messaging because it's always messaging. And Fitzpatrick is brilliant at messaging. And he really does a good job of showing, like, of playing himself as a moderate. Mm-hmm. And the way that we counter that is to let people know all of the ways that he's not a moderate because his voting record is actually pretty terrible. The last time I was here that you were kind enough to host me, we talked about some of the votes that he took that burnished his credentials as a moderate and how he sells himself that way. But what I would really love to talk about are all of the votes that he doesn't want us talking about because there are topics that he will run away from. And those are the things that we have to talk about with our friends, with our neighbors, with people in our social circle, because perfect example is just today, my husband comes home from walking the dog and he had walked past a neighbor who we know is progressive because she has commented on some of the stuff that I've had in the like letters to the editor and stuff. And she yelled out to him something to the effect of, "Hey, did you see that Fitzpatrick voted for the infrastructure bill? I'm going to have to call and do a thank you for that." And the thing is this, Indivisible does teach us that we're supposed to send thank you, you know, do thank yous when lawmakers do things that are good. But I'm not sending him a thank you note for this one because I know how hard he worked to try to delay and kill the Build Back Better plan.
Right.
And that's the bill that I really support. Like, bridges, roads, yes, we need to pay for them. But what we really need to work on is building back our infrastructure, our care infrastructure, because those are the folks who get underpaid. Those are the programs that are insufficient right now. And Fitzpatrick worked really hard with the Problem Solvers Caucus to take that behind the woodshed. I mean, like, he did not want that passed.
No, absolutely. And he even says, and you have this in, and I believe, yeah, this is from your Members of Congress tracking report that was just released on the 7th, right? And you say, this is from Brian Fitzpatrick's official website. He says, quote, "With the House passage of the historic bipartisan Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, we are one step closer to fixing our nation's crumbling physical infrastructure. This is a victory not only for the people of Pennsylvania, but for the entire country," right? So there's his like, hey, here I am. This is like me, the moderate. But then he says, "From the start, I've insisted on the passage of a hard infrastructure bill delinked from any other partisan social spending package. This bipartisan physical infrastructure bill, which passed the Senate in August with strong Republican support, is entirely separate from the partisan reconciliation bill, which I oppose." And that's the Build Back Better Act, right?
Yes, it is. And what the subtext of that is infrastructure, what he calls traditional infrastructure, the hard infrastructure, will end up paying for jobs that go 90% to men. The social safety net and social programs that are in the Build Back Better Act go predominantly to jobs that are staffed by women and that are paid a lot less than the men that are in the construction field. So what he's basically saying is, I'm all too happy to pay for jobs that go to guys, but women, you can fend for yourself. And that's infuriating because, frankly, could we have a thriving economy if there weren't people taking care of children when they aren't in school? Could we have a thriving economy if people who are disabled or aged aren't getting home and community-based care? No. That we need those care jobs because, as the hashtag says on Twitter, care is essential. It is essential. So, yeah, it's infuriating. And that is the kind of thing that we have to talk about, how hard the Problem Solvers Caucus worked to de-link those bills, how hard they worked to stall and delay. And guess what? He's a co-chair of the Problem Solvers Caucus. So that falls on him as much as it falls on Josh Gottheimer from New Jersey.
Right. And this is how, you know, where you see things like bipartisanship or this kind of moniker of moderate or whatever being wielded really as a weapon. And I think exactly as you pointed out, as a weapon that has implications, like has, let's put it this way, it hits women harder, right?
Yeah, it does.
Than it does men, right? So he can cozy up to some folks like, say, for example, in the building trades and things, which he always gets kind of support for and kind of building that quote unquote hard infrastructure. And yet, as we saw through COVID, I mean, if anything, COVID should alert us all to what is absolutely essential for make our economy function. It's childcare, it's teachers, it's home care work, it's nursing, right? I mean, all these things, which exactly as you say, are disproportionately staffed or traditionally staffed by women, right? And again, and that's all the stuff that's in the Build Back Better bill. Not to mention all the things that have a give us a shot in the dark in defeating climate change. Right. And getting to the point where we're actually, and again, who are going to be the people that are going to be most negatively impacted by climate? Right. Once again, it's going to be that caring infrastructure. And it's also going to be people of color and people at risk, people who are already on the margins of society. And that's what his caucus did to split the. And then on top of it, I'm sorry about this, but they originally agreed to a $3.5 billion thing and they freaking lied about it. Because as soon as it got over, then they start whittling it back down to make it even smaller than it initially was. And then they say that then this is the compromise when we're about half of what the compromise was supposed to be. So,
right. Which it goes to show. So early on this year, Indivisible was pushing the Thrive Agenda, which was like a really, really large. Honestly, it was an $8 trillion package, but it was all of the things that we wanted in the Build Back Better Act, but more and larger. So more for college, more for early childhood education, more for rebuilding and relinking communities that were cut off by highway projects in the past, a lot having to do with racial equity. And we were asking for the larger bill because we knew that this would get whittled down. And we hoped we would land at a number that would be sufficient to the needs of the time. It doesn't seem like we're going to land there, though hopefully Build Back Better will still pass. We still have time. But, you know, it's not as big as what we need. And Brian Fitzpatrick is a major part of why that didn't happen.
And will continue to fight against it, as he's made clear in his own press release on his own website.
Yes.
Right.
He will.
So to get to your point about, look, one of the things that's going to have to be essential if there's any chance of defeating Fitzpatrick, right, and kind of and flipping this seat here, is to really start exposing some of those, exactly as you said, those bills and those votes that he doesn't want to run on, right? So can you walk us through some of the kind of like, you know, let's call it, say, some of the worst votes of Brian Fitzpatrick? We should have like a little jingle play or something like this that will take us into some of those votes, right? You know, should be a special segment on this show.
One of these days I will send over to you an audio file of the derpy noise that his doorbell used to make. And it would be the perfect audio thing. It's like,
oh, please do.
It's very goofy. Anyway, that said, let's go into his worst votes. So what I think is going to be one of the most important issues of the 2022 election, because of the Supreme Court schedule and the fact that they'll be deciding on, I believe it's the Mississippi case, has to do with women's reproductive freedom or reproductive freedom in general. So Brian Fitzpatrick has a horrible record on that. In 2017, he voted for a 20-week abortion ban. Just this term, earlier this year, he voted against the Women's Health Protection Act, I believe it's called. It's a bill that basically would have codified Roe into law so that it wouldn't have to be a Supreme Court precedent anymore. It would just be a law. And it's not just that. It's that he still does fundraisers and does actions with those crisis pregnancy centers. Those are those groups that like advertise on the internet as if they perform abortions, but right. They don't. Their whole job is to drag women in and then tell them that abortion's horrible and divert them towards adoption. Not that there's anything wrong with adoption, but you know, if you're looking for an abortion provider and you land upon a site that looks like it's one, and then you go there and you find out they're trying to railroad you, that's some BS. And he fundraises with them. So he is very clearly an enemy of choice. And we need to hammer that. I know that's a divisive issue, but the fact is there are tons, I mean, a divisive issue in a swing district. That's what I mean by divisive issue. But the fact is there are tons of Democrats who vote for Brian Fitzpatrick. And if you're a Democrat, you need to know that he is an enemy of choice. You just need to. Not that everyone makes that their single issue voting, but it's something that voters need to consider. It can't just be he's a nice guy. He's a nice guy who's going to keep your future child or your niece or nephew from being able, sorry, your niche from being able to access legal and safe abortions. He will send them to the back alley.
Absolutely. And I think that you look, and I just a quick point on the, say, the divisive issue thing is like, mm-hmm. is like one thing, you know, I think this is one of the signals that we have to be prepared going forward. I mean, I think that anybody who's going to be running against Fitzpatrick needs to be campaigning on reproductive rights and being a defender of reproductive rights. Because I think that, well, a lot of sometimes what happens when we call things that are divisive, it's because the other side is so loud, right? Yeah. And I think that sometimes, like, you know, Democrats tend to kind of shirk away from feeling uncomfortable, right? Or thinking that the loudness indicates like how this. And I'm not like saying that and saying, oh no, really, everything's great. But you know, it's not as divisive as it was maybe even 10 years ago. And I think polling has been pretty good about saying, you know, women support and men support a women's right to choose. And I think that's absolutely critical.
I would agree. What I meant in bringing up it as divisive is there's so often advice from campaign strategists saying like, oh, talk about taxes, talk about healthcare, talk about the economy. And that's pretty much the extent of it. But what I'm getting at is I don't think there will be any way to avoid the issue of reproductive freedom Absolutely. In the 2022 race. There's just no way because of the Supreme Court schedule and the case that they picked up and Texas, of course, too. So we need to just keep hammering. Brian Fitzpatrick is an enemy of choice. He has 100%. Voted several times against things that would protect reproductive freedoms.
Cyril just chimed in the chat, basically said he's a coat hanger Republican. I'll go with that.
Yeah. Cyril, great phrase. I'm borrowing it there you or go. Stealing.
I think it's actually no copyright on that one. So go ahead.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, we can talk about impeachment. I don't know how key it's going to be for this coming election. It really depends on how much Donald Trump makes a stink of things in the lead up to 2022. But the fact is Fitzpatrick runs as a former law enforcement person, having been in the FBI, and he voted against impeachment twice. What really chaps me a bit is the second time around, he is the one who introduced a censure resolution that pretty much said all of the same things that the impeachment resolution said. And his argument was, impeachment's too divisive. Let's just censure him and then move forward. And it seems to fly in the face of everything that a law enforcement official should be saying, which is, this guy not just broke the law, but like violated aspects of the Constitution. We need to stand up for that. The Constitution. And Brian Fitzpatrick's like, no, we'll just do a censure.
Yeah, I mean, you would think if you're going to run as being like the former FBI guy, you'd think at the very least that would be a kind of a clear line in the sand when you're, you know, basically dealing with someone who's in constant violation of the Constitution. I don't know. Just seems like a gimme to me.
You really would think that. My point in terms of messaging, though, is I think that that's one of those things that we bring up if Trump is making a jerk of himself, but I don't think we should only be running on tying Fitzpatrick to Trump.
Yep.
We need to show how he has betrayed his constituents as well as betraying the Constitution. And along those lines, in terms of doing things that did not serve his constituents, we have to look at his no votes on a number of the COVID-related bills. Because he voted no to protecting people from pandemic-related evictions and foreclosures. He voted no to extending unemployment. He voted no to those stimulus payments during the pandemic. Like, he did not want to help people make it through this trying period. And that is horrifying. I mean, he has 750,000 constituents. Almost all of them had to have been negatively affected by this pandemic. I mean, there are very few people who benefited from it. Most of them are already billionaires and didn't need the help.
Right.
So he betrayed us in placing those no votes. And we have to remember that and talk about it.
I think that's a super important point, because this is one of those examples of, you know, one of these votes that he's not going to want to campaign on, not going to want to talk about, obviously. And I don't think a lot of people know that, right? That's not front and center when they think about Brian Fitzpatrick, because of, you know, he's like effective as a in his PR campaigning. But that is, I mean, you talk about, especially in an area that has a fairly kind of strong presence of in the medical community, right, that were kind of hit really hard by COVID, by people that were out of work. And this bill, I mean, it's the bill that you're talking about, was HR 7301, right? And
yes.
And that would have ensured that people did not lose their home, right? It would impose a year-long moratorium on foreclosure and evictions, for example. Right.
Yep.
I mean, that would have made sure that it had given people a certain sense of security. Right. That, OK, you can't get back to your job, but you're not going to get thrown out of your home. So that,
and I know a lot of people like would complain that, like, oh, then it falls upon the landlords. But there were actually provisions in that bill that would have helped landlords as well. So it wasn't just like, oh, we're only helping like one type of person. Like, no, this was to help everyone in the real estate markets deal with the problem of you can't go out because we need you to stay home and not give other people disease. What are we doing evicting people? So it showed no compassion. And that's one of those things, is he likes to portray himself as someone who, you know, he goes to the Boy Scout events, he goes to celebrate elderly folks' 100th birthdays, but he wasn't showing compassion for the vast majority of his constituents when he voted no to those stimulus payments. It is something we definitely have to talk about. I think we also have to talk about, though, because voting rights are so in the realm right now, is how many times he voted against election reforms.
Yeah.
So there were multiple packages in the 116th Congress, the last one. So we're not necessarily talking about just the voting rights bills that are pending right now, though he did vote against those too. We're talking about there were some that, right, mandating disclosure of foreign assistance for candidates.
That kills me, that one right there.
Right, providing funding to bolster election security. These are basic things that should be bipartisan, to use his word. He voted against them along with almost all Republicans. I think actually those were party line votes. He also is the front man, so to speak, for the Republicans' new election integrity bill. I'm sorry, I don't have the number here. I know I said it in the last time I was on the podcast, but the thing that gets me on that one is he likes to portray that bill as being like something that's widely agreed upon. But one of the issues in that, in his own bill, has to do with signature verification. And as someone who is, I have a disability, I have rheumatoid arthritis that affects my joints, signature verification is a horrible provision that's going to disenfranchise anyone who has muscle tremors, who has weakness, who has swelling, who has chronic pain. There's any number of conditions that can make your signature change. And if you are a person who does who does mail-in voting like I do, and I would even if we didn't have the extended Act 77 here in Pennsylvania, because I can't stand in line at the polls, It means that a clerk is going to decide if I'm me by looking at my signature, whereas my signature varies from day to day. There are days I can't hold a pen. So he has a bill that is specifically designed to disenfranchise elderly and disabled people. That's where he's at on this. So it's not just his votes against these election reforms, but also the fact that he's putting forth his own that would hurt his own constituents.
That's crazy. It doesn't sound very moderate to me when you start poking
around. No, it doesn't sound moderate to me either. Let's do a flashback as well, because this one was one that I know really affected people here in Bucks County based on the number of folks who showed up for events on it. And that was in 2019 when all the information came out about the kids being detained in cages and family separation. That may have actually been even earlier than it came out. I'm sorry, I'm messing up my dates. But in 2019, there was a bill that came up. It was HR 3239. And it said the most basic things in it having to do with humane standards for detention. It was like, there will be only 12 people per toilet. You will have X number of feet of sleeping space in a room, that they have to be able to turn down or out the lights at night so you can sleep, that you have access to soap and toothbrushes and toilets, like three meals a day. It mandated really basic things, and Fitzpatrick voted against it. It was a party line vote. And I know that we we at Indivisible took that one really hard. And that was one of those events that we had a very large sign in front of his office that I can share pictures of after this conversation that we're having that said Fitz voted to keep kids in cages. But that is what it comes down to. And this is something that can be brought up again, even though it feels like history. Because the Biden administration is taking steps to try to provide some level of, I don't know the right word, but funding for families who were separated to help defray the costs of the psychological, you know, the therapy that's going to be needed for these kids growing up. And Republicans are standing against that as well. There hasn't been a vote on that. I think that is an administration only, you know, something that's done within the bureaucracy, but it is something that's still in the news again. And we can keep pointing back to the fact that not only isn't Fitzpatrick showing compassion now, but back then he didn't show it either.
You know, this makes me want to think, like, you know, I'm looking at these, you know, I'm looking at this, you know, this one you have, you know, member tracker special, the Brian Fitzpatrick top 10 worst votes, right? And this one goes up, you said it only went up to like, what, 20?
It went up to the 2020 election. We have more now.
Right, there's more now. You know, I'm thinking like, you know, I'm serious. My wheels are turning here about ways of organizing around this and providing access to organize. I mean, obviously, I'm going to put a link to this stuff, right, directly in the show notes today. I'm even thinking like, you know, it'd be cool to have like little, almost like little playing cards, like a deck of the bad votes, right, that we could kind of circulate.
I love that.
Yeah, I mean, I think
We did a blast of Melissa Brannigan, who shows up as I Am Melza on Twitter. She had organized a Fitzpatrick failed us Twitter storm in the lead up, I think, to the 2020 election. And we highlighted a lot of these. But yeah, we do need to, they should be talking points in early canvassing where we have the conversational canvassing as opposed to just get out the vote stuff. Like, people do need to know about that. Can I point out one more one?
Oh, no, please, really please. Yes.
So this is a nitpicky one, but it points out a habit of his. So Brian introduces a lot more bills than most lawmakers do. He introduces them, he issues a press release about it, he gets coverage for it, and then he never does anything ever again. There are a couple of Democrats who do similar things, and they'll co-sponsor each other's bills a lot, and then they disappear. So there is a bill he had introduced recently within the last couple months that had to do with corporate outsourcing. And he introduced it to great fanfare. Oh, we're going to do this and create a list of these corporate outsourcers who are sending jobs outside of the community. He was all indignant about it and, you know, self-righteous. Not 2 years ago, he voted against almost that same exact bill. So the bill was HR 3624. It was in the 116th Congress, and it would have required businesses to publicly report how many American jobs they've sent overseas, and he voted no. And now he's turned around and reintroduced almost the same exact bill himself, except a weaker version of it. So it makes it clear that the only reason he's done that is because of the messaging.
That's performative. 100% performative.
He wants to be able to talk about outsourcing and be a good guy on it when he placed a vote against that very same issue. He did the same thing earlier on in the Trump administration when it came to releasing Trump's taxes. So he voted a ton of times to table motions that Democrats had brought up trying to force the issue of Trump's taxes. And then at the very end of the 115th Congress, he introduced his own bill about releasing presidential taxes.
Because of course he did.
Of course he did. So So it's just, it's all of a pattern. Can I really quickly run down some of the worst votes of this session? I'm going to go kind of speed round on you if you don't
mind.
The
reason why that that Kirsten's got to do the speed round now is she's got a heart out tonight too, as well, just to be clear. So we're not trying to rush the conversation here. Just letting you know that there's a reason why we're kind of blowing through the end of these things right here. Okay.
I am so sorry about that. I hope to come back and talk about these again.
I'm glad you
could come on. So some of the worst ones this term so far. So we talked about impeachment already, and we talked about COVID relief already. He also voted against the police reform bill, which he had previously supported, but then didn't in the past Congress, but then didn't support it in this Congress. He voted against DC statehood. There was there's this thing called the Congressional Review Act that lets Congress reverse a previous president's enacted laws. It's a little bit wonky, and I don't want to go too much into it, but more or less, the Trump administration put in a rule that made it easier for, like, payday lenders to use the rules of, like, the most lenient state instead of having to go by the rules of the state that they exist in. And it really affects people who are lower income and economically disadvantaged, and Fitzpatrick voted against reversing that horrible rule. He voted against the January 6th Select Committee. He voted against the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And he voted against the resolutions that were going to move the infrastructure bills forward. Because as he talked about, he didn't want them linked together. So that's why he voted against it. And he voted against extending the debt limit. So he is just a font of really bad votes. But they happen to be really technical issues for the most part, whereas he can turn around and say, oh, I voted for union protections, the PRO Act, or oh, I vote for the Equality Act. But those are bills that aren't getting signed into law because they get stopped by the filibuster in the Senate.
Well, you know, I think just to be fair, right, to Brian Fitzpatrick, we should talk about his at least one of his yes votes, right, for like yes to massive corporate tax cuts, right? The guy who wants to worried about the deficit and worried about the budget and worried about the debt limit, but he voted against the massive corporate tax cuts that were kind of a redistribution of wealth from the bottom to the top, right? So if you want something to vote for him for, there you go. That's his
He voted for the Trump tax scam or the GOP tax scam, however you want to call it, that if I remember correctly, isn't it something like 82 or 83% of the benefits went to the richest Americans?
80% to the top 1%.
Yeah. It's just, he has a bad record, and we need to talk about his bad record. We have to be willing to do that. And the hard work is, this isn't something that is easy to put on a bumper sticker, and it isn't something that's easy to put on, you know, a lawn sign. It's a conversation that we have to have with people around us. It's the conversation that one of these days it's going to be me walking the dog and going up to talk to that neighbor who thanked Fitzpatrick for the infrastructure vote. Be like, let me tell you about some of the really awful things he's done. Please remember these two.
Absolutely. And, you know, and as daunting as that may sound to some folks, is like, you know, next week in our conversation with Laura Putnam, we're going to be talking about exactly this stuff. It's actually what seems to be like, oh God, we got to have these conversations and things like this. These are the hard stuff. That's actually where our power is based. It's based in our relationships. It's based in our communities and our relationships in our community. So that's where we can actually have and maximize our impact, right? It's not just sharing, you know, sharing stuff on social media or signing petitions and things like that. That's all, you know, kind of parts of the components and all that kind of stuff. But really it's those conversations where it's our strength. And this kind of stuff that you're doing, right? Kind of breaking down the no votes, breaking down some of his worst votes, is ammunition for all of us, right? To be able to take and have those conversations. That's why I'm thinking about these little cards and this kind of stuff. How do we make it accessible so people can use it in the communities that they're organizing? And, you know, so thank you so much for this work. I mean, it's fantastic.
Thank you. And I will say this, my dream is that someone out there is going to listen to this conversation, and perhaps if you put up the link to the top 10 worst votes from his past Congresses, we'll pick one of them and write a 250-word letter to the Bucks County Courier-Times or Intelligencer about why that one bill peeves you that he voted no on it. Because that's what we have to keep the conversation going and talk to the people in our circles and through our local media outlets.
100%. Well, listen, you know, I know you got to get out of here. But I'm just going to ask you, say one, you said you got some kind of events coming up, or do you have any, say, closing thoughts that you want to leave us with, or kind of plugs that you want to make before you got to take off?
Sure. So we do have events on the 11th and the 12th, so later on this week, Thursday and Friday. The Thursday event is going to be 6 o'clock at the Lambertville New Hope Bridge. Both of these are related to ending the filibuster. And 6 o'clock on Friday night is going to be at the intersection of 413 and 332, which happens to be Fitzpatrick's office.
Oh, that's weird.
We're going to be along the roadway there just because people are used to meeting up there. But if you can't make it yourself to those, do try to get on social, share around some content. We're using hashtag end the filibuster and hashtag time to act. And if you can take a peek at it's Bucks Co. Kirsten, K-I-E-R-S-T-Y-N, on Twitter. I have that mock track up as often as Congress votes. I get the report up on behalf of myself, Gary with Lower Bucks Indivisible, Volunteer Cece, and Volunteer Linda.
Well, fantastic. Well, we'll get links up to all of that. And if I can't find the links, I'm going to call you back and I'm going to say, hey, give me the links to that.
So that works. Thank you so much, Kevin. I really appreciate the time tonight. You have a wonderful evening.
Oh, you do too as well. So thank you so much, Kirsten, for joining us tonight. And thank you all for tuning in. Listen, we're going to take a quick break. And after this break, you know, if you got additional comments, if you got some questions, you can call into the show. Information on how to do that is on riverside.fm. That's in tonight's show notes on YouTube. So you can just kind of click on that. Listen on riverside.fm. Make sure you turn down the volume on your YouTube just so that you don't get any of the feedback or the delays and things like this. And I'll have some closing thoughts and some stuff coming up about where we're going. So, Kirsten, have a great night, and we'll see you soon. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We'll be back right after this quick break. Hey, everybody. Here I am once again. We're back after the break. Great talk with Kirsten Zolfel tonight. And I will definitely get links to these, you know, some of these documents. I'm telling you, this Member of Congress Tracker Report, the mock track special, Brian Fitzpatrick, top 10 worst votes. This stuff is like gold because it allows us to kind of break it up into kind of nice little chunks. And I like what she said there, too, as well, is like once you have access to something like this, you can just choose one of them. You don't have to go over the whole record. It's not all on your shoulders. We're all in this together. And choose one of them and kind of shoot off a kind of a letter to the editor about kind of why this kind of pisses you off or why this upsets you. I do think it's going to be absolutely critical that we're building the case for why it is that we need to be voting against Fitzpatrick, right? Why it is that we need to kind of get him out of there. Because it's not just a matter of having a D in that office. It has to be, you know, some really significant things. And, I got to say, one of the most, you know, if I had to put this at the top of my list, why it's so critical to get him kind of out of there and get someone in there who's, you know, going to be an ally when it comes to reproductive rights. I mean, if you look at what's going through the Supreme Court right now, it's, you know, it's devastating what can potentially be happening here. I mean, we're seeing what's happening in Texas, right? And if that is allowed to go kind of nationwide, I mean, this is like, you know, let's send us back to the dark alleys, like literally. This has got to be stopped. And Brian Fitzpatrick is not an ally in this fight. So, you know, at the very least, if you give half a crap about reproductive rights and kind of women's rights, you cannot be voting for Brian Fitzpatrick. And we got to be making that case to people. I look at, you know, I look at this list of these, you know, top 10 worst votes for Brian Fitzpatrick, you know, think, you know, the one that pisses me off the most, like, I don't even know. Well, here, check this one out. Right. I don't think we even talked about this one. This is, he voted no to extending unemployment and stimulus payments during the pandemic. In response to the coronavirus pandemic, the House had passed legislation to help various sectors of our society in phases. Fitzpatrick was fine with extending the programs to help business, but when the time came to help for individuals, Fitzpatrick said no. In voting against H.R. 6800, our congressman denied extended unemployment to tens of millions of Americans and kept us all from getting another stimulus payment. That's a concrete harm that he has caused, right? I mean, obviously, he didn't do it by himself, but he was one of the people that helped harm others, help harm people in our communities. Right. And if we're going to sit there and try to protect each other in our community, right, if we want a representative who's not going to do harm to us in the community, but is actually going to help the community, this guy's got to go. Right. Now, I recognize that there's people out there who might be listening to this, who, you know, might have talked to you, might be talking to people who talk about Fitzpatrick as being kind of a nice guy. And look, he might be pleasant to talk to. Right. He might be, you know, a kind of guy that, you know, doesn't give you the creeps every time you're around, right? I don't know. You might actually have had a conversation with him and found him to be, you know, personable. Great. Fantastic. But we don't elect somebody so that we can have a friend, right? We elect somebody that is going to kind of do what we want them to do when it comes to Congress. It's as simple as that. I mean, do you want to make sure that people in our community have what they need in times of crisis? Yes or no? If you don't give a shit, fine, vote for Fitzpatrick. But if you actually think that should be part of the values of this community, you cannot vote for Fitzpatrick. And you need to encourage other people not to vote for him as well. Right? Things like that. And I think it's just a very, it's a baseline of kind of, like a mindset kind of moving forward, that we're not voting for personality, we're voting for stuff. We're voting for a future. We're voting for our values. And if our values mean that we take care of each other, if our values mean that, you know, people who kind of threaten our Constitution and try to overthrow the government are going to pay the price or at least be held accountable, if we value reproductive rights, women's rights, the right to access to kind of like safe and affordable, free even abortion, guess what? We got to be fighting for that. And one of the things that Kirsten said, and we kind of blew past it pretty quickly, but, you know, one of the things that she said when we were talking about the need to fight around reproductive rights is that she said, you know, look, there's going to be consultants who are going to come into this race and they're going to try to tell Democratic candidates, whoever that ends up being, to kind of not talk about reproductive rights, to talk about things that are non-controversial. And I think she said it absolutely right. There's not a choice here. It's like the Fitzpatrick and the Republicans, whether it's coming out of Fitzpatrick's mouth himself or all his operatives, right, that will be doing all the dirty work around this election, they will be fighting over removing the rights of women to get an abortion. It's not a choice. It's just like the candidates who are running for school board, right? I mean, everyone that I talk to who's running for school board, whether it's on this show or kind of off this show, none of them wanted to be talking about, like, critical race theory, right? You know, I mean, that's not why they got into the race. They got into the race because they saw that things, you know, they saw that things were going haywire on these school boards and they wanted to do better. They wanted to do right by the kids, right? But it became obvious pretty quickly that you can't avoid race and try to kind of like take the high road or something like that. No, you have to do battle. And, you know, I'm not talking about physical battle, but I'm talking about political battle. What are we standing for? You know, there was an interesting conversation that I heard on, what was it, the Betty Hassan show on Sunday night, right? And oh god, I can't believe I'm going to space her name right now. She's one of the women who's basically founded critical race theory, like, you know, three decades ago. I can't believe I'm forgetting her name. But anyways, he asked a really good question. And one of the questions he said is, look, the impulse has been, you know, on these school board elections or in these races where they bring up this critical race theory, the impulse has been to say, look, critical race theory is not taught in schools. It's not taught in K-12 schools. That's not even there. Right. And that is an accurate statement. Right. It's an accurate statement that critical race theory is something that's taught in law schools. And, you know, to some degree, you might pick some stuff up in sociology, or you might pick some things up in, I don't know, history classes or something like this, like at the college level. Right. Maybe in graduate school level, we start kind of looking at some of these things. Right. It's a way of trying to understand the way that kind of our legal infrastructure perpetuates like systemic racism. Right. I mean, that's kind of what it was trying to kind of understand and why they kind of started doing it, because they were trying to solve that problem, trying to figure out how this stuff is maintained. Let's look at the legal stuff. Anyways. So Betty Hassan is basically saying, you know, hey, look, you know, is that the right move? Right. You know, it's an accurate move. It's true that it's not taught in K-12 schools. But maybe we should fight on that one. Right. And I'm not saying, like, let me put it this way. Critical race theory was never about critical race theory. Critical race theory was about maintaining white supremacy, was about squashing down any discussion of diversity and kind of like what those folks saw as anti-American, which really is like true history, complicated history, the conflicts, the violent past of this country, the contradictions, the brutality, the genocides, all that stuff. They didn't want to mention that. They want to whitewash history. That's what it was about, right? Republicans have always done this, especially the right wing, right? They use these kind of like dog whistle moves, right? They say critical race theory, but really what they are saying is that who are those people to think that they have a right to what I have? It is about disciplining people of color. And it is about maintaining whiteness as a privileged space. And I'm not saying they're all conscious of doing that at all, but in order to have that conversation, you have to fight on those grounds, right? I'll tell you this, I want my kids to approach everything critically. I don't want them to swallow dogma. I don't want them to kind of be given a whitewashed version of American history, of their own history, of our family history, anything. That is part of what it means to be an alive and fully present human being in the world, right? You can live in complexity and recognize complexity and contradictions and all that stuff is there, you know, be able to apprehend that and understand it so we don't do it over and over again. By ignoring it, you guarantee its repetition. And the problem is, of course, and why I think this stuff sparked up so much right now is because, you know, all the pressures on that white supremacist way of thinking, all that pressure on the kind of like traditional values, America's good and that's it, capital G good, we don't do anything bad kind of stuff, right? We've got a weird history in this country, right, of not being able to deal with, you know, discomfort, and it's a shame. But anyways, it was an interesting question, you know, and it was an interesting question about kind of what we do going forward. My big point about even saying that, I'm sorry, kind of got off on that little track, but the whole idea there is that we need to be advocating for things and figuring out what it is that we stand for. What are the values that we're arguing for? And I don't mean consultant approved sound bites. I mean, what is it we care about? What are we willing to fight for? I don't know about you. Reproductive rights is one of these things. That's non-negotiable, right? I mean, putting kids in cages, non-negotiable. Book bannings of books by Nobel Prize winning, like, people of color, non-negotiable. No, sorry. No. And we should feel strength in that, not defensiveness. We are for treating people in the way that they should be treated and try to understand the different conditions that we come from so that we can rectify the problem, right? I mean, how do you know? If you're not willing to just know and to find out and be curious in the world, then we're stuck, right? And that's certainly not where we want to go. You know, so what's the story we're going to tell here in the organizing? Anyways, it goes on. I do want to reiterate one more thing is that, you know, I mentioned this in the show on last week, but I do want to say again that I think that the organizing that has gone on in Bucks County has been outstanding. And yes, we lost these school board elections, not all of them, right? But some really key ones like Penridge, Palisades, right? But won two seats in Central Bucks, which is good, right? Yes, we lost a bunch of row offices, but there were some successes, you know, so we've got a mixed bag. We got to see that for what it is, but recognize that what was going on, the organizing that was happening in this community was outstanding, right? And is precisely what we need to double down on. You know, I'm forgetting who said this now, but there was another interview that I was listening to, or was basically saying, you know, you hear this adage, you know, keep on doing the same thing over and over again, expect different results is the definition of insanity. And this person was listening to you was basically saying, you know, it's actually an organizing. That's the opposite, right? Doing the same thing over and over again, right, is precisely what it is. It's that kind of that stick-to-itness. It's to keep on talking to people, to not give up on people, to, you know, make sure that we're kind of not going to back down. We're not going to fall to despair. We're going to look for those spaces of community, right, to kind of build power. Right. Now, we didn't talk about this at all tonight about the race coming forth in 2022. You know, we've got, you know, Ashley Ahas is running against Fitzpatrick for Democratic seat. The other Democrat who's in the race is this guy, Paul Fermo. Right. They're both kind of military veterans and things like this. And that's going to play itself out. We didn't talk at all about that tonight. We'll get there. As this race gets going on. But, you know, one of the things that I hope people hold on to in after coming out of this 2021 election and these school board races is that the power is in the community, is in those organizations that we're building. And we've talked a little bit about this. I talked about this on last Monday's show too as well, about the need to, you know, really start thinking about building a Bucks County-wide from my end, a kind of a media infrastructure, but also kind of an organization, and not one that is kind of, you know, flown in from outside, right? But one that is kind of organically growing out of the work that's already being done. So, you know, I mean, I even think about things like, what would it look like to have like a, you know, I don't know what you call it, almost like a Bucks County convention, right? Of like all these organizers that worked on these school boards, right? To kind of have a space and do this. And, you know, and I'll tell you, this is one of the things that I hope that this doesn't have to be the case, but I'm saying that is certainly the place where, you know, we have our Discord, right? So our Discord, Raging Chicken one, we can set up channels and spaces in there to kind of have some of these discussions about Bucks County. We can find, you know, whether it's Facebook groups or whatever it might be, Zoom meetings, whatever it might be, but to kind of touching base with some of the organizers in all these different districts and start talking about, you know, developing our own plan. And what are we going to demand of the candidates who are running against Fitzpatrick? Right. Because if we don't do it, this consultant class, right, that never does quite well. Go look at what happened in Virginia. The consultant class will run this election for us. So what is it that we want? What are we going to demand the Democratic nominee to run on? What questions are we going to ask? And we shouldn't be afraid to ask those questions. Right? I have no idea how this primary is going to play out on the Democratic side, but I certainly know that they need to be paying attention to us. Right? And I'm hesitant to even include myself in that, but really, I mean, they should be paying attention to the organizers who did all the work around these school board elections, who did all the work on the ground and going door to door, knocking on doors for candidates, right? Those people who started out, they were first-time organizers, never thought they would be doing door to door knocking, and then ended up showing up every single week. I've heard story after story of people who are like, yeah, this really isn't my thing. And by the time they ended up being kind of like, you know, one of the kind of like leaders of their group, right? You know, who's always going to be there to be counted on, right? Every single week. That we should be proud of and we should nurture among ourselves. So, you know, kudos there. So we'll have to kind of play around a little bit with this stuff. I mean, like I've said, I've kind of hinted at before. I've been talking to some people about doing this on the media end of stuff. But I would love to kind of, you know, batter on ideas with some people about where we should go from here, right? How do we connect people? Right. You know, the folks in the Penridge School District with the Palisades School District with the kind of, you know, Central Bucks School District in a way that we're kind of like, you know, at least proverbially in the same room. I mean, God, I can't wait till we can get back to actually be in the same room all the time with each other. But, you know, because it's getting cold and everything like this. But, you know, where we can start talking about what are those issues that matter to us? What are those things that are absolutely critical? You know, because the long run, in my view, right, is that we need to be generating our own candidates. Right. This movement that is, you know, in its beginning stages here in Bucks County, this movement needs to generate its own candidates. Ones that are rooted in Bucks County. Ones that are connected to an existing social movement and that are not dependent on like the DCCC, for example, for their money. Right. But that's a long game and we got a ways to get there. Right. But we've got the workings of it right in front of us. Right in front of us, right in each other. So kudos to all you. I mean, this is something that Cyril has said over and over again about his column, right? He's like, he owes so much to the community and the activists who are doing this work, right? Because he wouldn't be able to do half of what he's doing if it not for the community was doing this. That his vision for what he wants to do and that space in that column in his newsletter, right, was to kind of help kind of like bring that community together, to help foster and nurture that community. To find it like a place of expression where that community's work can be acknowledged and valued, right? So here we have it. So anyways, everyone, thank you all for tuning in tonight. It's been awesome. I always love talking to Kirsten. Always love talking to you. Always love to see the comments. And I want to remind you that next week we've got Laura Putnam on the show. She is a professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. And she's got some great pieces out. I mean, one of the ones that I mentioned before, see, I've got like all this stuff that I'm reading right now. One that I mentioned kind of earlier before was her, let me just get up the, so I don't mess up the title once again. We're going to be talking a bit about it was in the journal Democracy, right? It's called Democracy, a Journal of Ideas, and it's called Rust Belt in Transition, What Has Happened in Pennsylvania's and the Rust Belt's Middle Suburb Counties and Can It Be Reversed? She, if you're not following her on Twitter, you need to do that immediately. Laura Putnam's Twitter account is fantastic. And she's been doing a breakdown of last week's elections that is just indispensable. You can follow her at Laura, L-A-R-A underscore Putnam, P-U-T-N-A-M, Laura Putnam, or just search for her on Twitter at L-A-R-A-P-U-T-N-A-M, Laura Putnam. She's phenomenal in terms of breaking down the elections, and she's been following a lot of what's been happening in Western Pennsylvania in terms of they've been building kind of progressive and left power there. That article, Rust Belt in Transition, is really about, you know, how there was a kind of gradual disconnect between working class communities and the Democratic Party in Western Pennsylvania, and then how that's beginning to change. And she's been talking a lot about that, the organizing that's been going on Twitter. She's also got this fantastic piece in The Forge called On Postcards and Superpowers, that was written in December after the 2020 election. And it's talking about a lot of this on the ground organizing that I was bringing up tonight. And so I hope we're going to talk a little bit about that too, as well. I cannot wait to talk to her. And to kind of pick her brain at a bunch of stuff, and, you know, to talk a little bit about what seems to be kind of happening in Pennsylvania and how, you know, organizing gets the goods. And finally, the I mentioned this at the beginning of the show again, too, as well, but I'm going to plug it again because I'm just like, I'm so thrilled, I got to say. So there, I got it right here, actually. I can actually, for those folks who are on YouTube right now, they can actually see this. This is the little book, right? It's Ancestry and Culture. An alternative alternative to race in 5E. And Gwen Marshall will be on the show on November 22nd to talk about this book. And, you know, look, like I haven't exactly hid the fact that one of the things that's been great this past year for me is that, one, my kids started getting interested in Dungeons & Dragons. I played for a little while. I think it was like maybe played a couple times in high school, but mostly in college. For some, and I absolutely loved it, and it always made me feel like, man, I wish I had this when I was growing up, like when I was younger, because it's just like I love D&D. So, you know, and I'll tell you a little bit about my pathway here, and you'll hear this again when I talk to Gwen Marshall on November 22nd. But so I started designing some campaigns and looking at some of these source books. And if anybody knows anything about Dungeons and Dragons, there's like, you know, these big source books and these monsters and all these rules and all this kind of stuff. But really, it's about kind of guided storytelling, right? That's in its best mode. It's not just about the math of, like, you know, rolling dice and all that stuff, although I love dice, I have to say. But so as I was getting back and thinking about planning some of the adventures for my kids, I started doing this one from this, you know, the starter set, but I've got some maps and things that I've started designing on my own for my own campaign. Right. Cause I've said, like, this is the coolest thing. Right. I mean, this is like, I need to, like, something that's full of life and joy. And this is it, right, for me right now, like, to be designing kind of maps in this world and think about a campaign. And I kept coming back to something just kind of gnawed at me. Right. And I remember this being, you know, I don't think I ever would have had the words for it when I was playing back in college. But now, so in D&D, when you choose a character, right? Or these kind of, there's these other characters who are the evil ones, right? You choose a class, right? Kind of thing like, are you a fighter? Are you a cleric? Are you blah, blah, blah. But then you choose a race, right? And you choose a race like elf or dwarf or orc or half orc or human, or, you know, there's a whole bunch of other ones too. Well, those are some of the most popular ones. Or gnome or something, right? And associated with each one of those races is a series of attributes, right? Which are kind of like built into the race, right? Immutable characteristics of the race, if you will, right? And it just kind of like sat wrong, right? Because I'm like, wait a minute, you know, everything we've talked about in terms of race, right? We've, you know, that hopefully we're at the point where we can say, understand that race is a construct, right? There are no races, right? It is a construct that is about power, exploitation, violence, white supremacy. This whole idea that a race is associated with a particular characteristic is deeply problematic at its core, right? And so I was like, huh. And then I said to myself, I was like, well, self, well, just because it says that there doesn't mean I have to do it, right? So I started constructing this campaign around some of these questions, right? And then I'm looking for resources. And I started looking for black D&D players, right? In different podcasts and things, because I've been following this one show called The Dungeon Run, and came across this one group called Three Black Halflings, which actually came on The Dungeon Run, and then started kind of like reading some articles about it. And there were some really amazing message boards that I started reading about. Like, there's people actually seriously engaged with these questions of race at a really deep level who love the game, right? And yet are kind of like, wait a minute, we can do this differently. And people kept pointing back to this book, right? Ancestry and Culture. So you're looking for a good one? Here's that. There's another one that came out from D&D. I'm gonna completely space the name right now, which is trying to loosen up some of these categories. But this one really goes right at it. And kind of talks about why it's so important to think about ancestry and culture as opposed to race. As a way of thinking about what happens in as you're constructing these characters, right? Now, you might be saying at this point, I don't care, Kevin. This is like D&D. I don't care about D&D. Here's the thing. And this is why I thought it was appropriate to ask Gwen Marshall to come on the show. Is because about a decade ago, this emergent, the alt-right, right? Remember the Richard Spencer, those whole characters where the Proud Boys grew out of, all that kind of stuff. One of the places that these folks intervened was in video game culture. Right? And it was, they basically would target people, right? On the one hand, to be brutal to, right? But they would also look at it as a place to recruiting and start to foster this kind of sense of white nationalism, of misogyny, of racism, of white supremacy, right? And they targeted kids, right? And the only reason I even knew half about this stuff was for two things. One, watching the Majority Report, right, with Sam Cedar, right? You had Matt Binder was on the show kind of a while back. And Matt Binder, he's got his own show called Doomed right now, which is great. But he would start talking about some of this, like this stuff going on in internet culture and social media, particularly around video games and all this kind of stuff. And it was like sounded to me like just fantasy stuff, right? And I think to Sam Cedar too. But as he started like paying attention to this stuff and kind of bringing up the what sounded crazy, then you start seeing these people in real life. And they're organizing in real life around kind of racism and white supremacy, right? This alt-right stuff. And it was coming out and being fostered in these communities and in the video game culture, right? And he was on it. And then also Sean Kitchen, right, started following and tracking these organizations as they were kind of making inroads in the in Pennsylvania. So we began to see the stuff. And so they use culture, right? And you remember Steve Bannon, right, from... Well, you know, we know him best now for being Trump's kind of right-hand man, right? The kind of the white supremacist there. But Steve Bannon and all the... Oh, God, what's his name? Why can't I think of the name of that publication? Oh, that's awful. Anyways, the guy who wrote that publication that he worked for before, oh, that's awful. But said basically, politics is downstream from culture. And this is a really important insight for how the right organizes, right? It's kind of like you change the culture, then you change the politics, right? It's a long-term vision. And the folks that intervened at that was there. So now is D&D the kind of the have the same kind of play as video games did? No. However, what happened during 2020, during the pandemic, is there was an explosion of Breitbart. Thank you, Emily. Oh, God, I could not believe it. I could not pull that out. Yes, Breitbart. And thank you, Cyril. Breitbart News. That's what Andrew Breitbart said, right? Kind of politics is downstream from culture. And one of the things that happened over COVID is that there was these games that, you know, in kind of corners of YouTube and stuff, there was one, it was called Critical Role, which people may have heard about, right? It was very, very popular kind of like, you know, TT RPG, right? So a tabletop role-playing game, right? But it was live. Right, so they have the characters that get on. They play D&D. There were voice actors who did it, and so on. and so a bunch of other shows like that started springing up. And over the summer, and I've told the story on our Friday show, is that my brother Ryan and I were kind of talking about this when I was visiting my folks up in Utica. And he's saying that he said, yeah, one of the things that helped him get through some of this stuff was this show called The Dungeon Run. Right. It's really fun. Great storytelling and all this. And then that encouraged him to start actually kind of playing with his friends again. Right. And so I said, oh, cool. Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. I need something to distract it because I was not feeling great at the time. So I started watching that show and it was great. It was fun. It was engaged. And it started back in 2019. So I blew through like 100 episodes since like the summer. Each episode is about 3 to 4 hours, but you know, I'd have it on in the background as I'm working and all this kind of stuff. But anyways, the show was really good. And one of the things that was really interesting about the Dungeon Run is that they, they decided to close all the shows by saying like humankind, you know, be both. And while they tried to avoid like diving overtly into politics, clearly the backdrop was Trump and all the stuff that was going on. And they saw this show as a place of kind of like, say, I don't know, thinking through some of that kind of at an affective or storytelling level, but not in a direct way, right? But it was always clear they would come back and they would kind of like raise these kind of questions, or when they would talk about it after the show and stuff, they would be that. And I thought that was really, really fascinating. And so as I started looking around more, finding, oh, wow, there's been an explosion of this stuff. And if you look at the actual, you know, the market reports and stuff, is that the interest in D&D and these online games, especially since there's these great kind of like online platforms where you can play this stuff in now, called like Roll20 and some other ones, this is another kind of potential cultural site. Except people in the D&D community are already doing some of this cultural work in really interesting ways around gender, around race, around sexuality. And it seems to me, and the difference between like a video game where you're just kind of like talking to each other, this is in storytelling mode, right? Where you're role-playing characters and things like this. And there's a really interesting opportunities there for community and thinking through hard questions in ways that doesn't require a nice, neat answer at the end of the, like at the end of the day. One is the way, kind of, one is the way to kind of develop this stuff and have these kind of conversations and to be it, and make it be about community and care. Right. So anyways, that's the reason why Gwen Marshall is going to be coming on the show. That's why we're going to be talking about Ancestry and Culture, an Alternative to Race in 5e on November 22nd. But next week, once, of course, we're going to have Laura Putnam on, professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. And we're going to be talking about her articles, Rust Belt in Transition, probably some stuff from Postcards and Superpowers, and kind of doing a little kind of reflection on what's happening in social movements and kind of building power in the state of Pennsylvania, west and east. Well, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Thank you all for tuning in tonight. Thank you all once again. Thanks to Emily and Cyril, especially, who kind of popped in here. I want to give a shout out. I got Sincerely Bold left a comment on this show a couple days ago before we went live. But I appreciate all this and want to remind you, do what you can, right, to kind of get the word out, share the show, encourage other folks to subscribe to the show, even if they're not big YouTube people. Right, you say, hey, listen, you do me a favor, go on over to this YouTube page and subscribe to the show. You never need to go back to it. Just go over and subscribe to the show. You find out you might like it, right? You're progressive, you like this kind of stuff. Here, you're going to tune in. What's about support this guy, right? Just by subscribing to the show, it gets the word out, right? Kind of again, because once you're starting to talk about YouTube and stuff, you're talking about the algorithms. And if we have people sharing the show and our subscriber base goes up, more people are going to see what we do, right? And we're going to be able to amplify the voices of people who bring on our shows like this. We'll be able to amplify the voice of Cyril. We'll be able to amplify the voice of the kind of political breakdowns that we do on Friday. So make sure you do that. Y'all, I love you. You've been doing a phenomenal job just like sharing our stuff out. I was like blown away today. Once again, I was watching, you know, the shares happen out on Twitter. Thank you so much for helping promote the show and helping get the word out. I want to remind you that if you haven't already, if you can, afford it and so on like this, you can become a patron of this show by going to patreon.com/rcpress. You can become a patron for as little as $5 a month. We'd love to have you aboard. If you're listening on the Podbean app, right, and you see that little kind of green patron button at the top, you can still hit that, right? You can still hit that. You can become a patron through the Podbean if you like. Anything else you to help out, but just sharing the show, subscribing to the podcast, subscribing to our YouTube channel is phenomenal. If you do subscribe to the podcast, especially if you're on Apple Podcast, make sure you kind of give us that 5-star rating and leave us a review. It helps us get the word out, which is like absolutely fantastic. I'm looking forward to like some amazing shows coming up. I have to figure out what's going to happen right before Thanksgiving. What that week is going to look like. I've been holding off about booking a guest for there yet because, you know, holidays and all that kind of stuff, but we shall see. But anyways, thank you all. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. It's always makes my day to start the week this way. A lot of week yet to come though. So we'll see where this goes. Let's hope the Build Back Better bill gets some traction. In the meantime, stay in there. Looking forward to seeing you next week. See ya!